This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 14th, 2012, Republican candidate Ron Paul announces that he will no longer be campaigning for president, putting a kind of closing bookend on one of modern America's more unique political careers. Paul was a trained doctor and ideological libertarian. He criticized elements of the government that others considered essential, and his surprising success early in this decade kind of provided a taste of how the internet and libertarian rhetoric was going to upend our politics and still is today. So let's talk about it. I'm joined, as always, by Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hey, Jody.
And here for his third episode in a row and his final episode with us for now, maybe we'll have you back in the future, is Harry Enten of CNN. Hello, Harry.
You know, when you say it like that, it just sounds so sad. Breaking my heart, Jody.
You'll be back. So, look, we'll talk a little bit about 2012 and Ron Paul there, but also I think this is our chance to do kind of Ron Paul and his place in larger American politics. So, Harry, looking at him in general, of all the elections he ran in, was he ever truly a threat or truly a major factor?
No, I don't think he was ever truly a threat or a threat to win the nomination, probably not. I mean, obviously, 2012 was the year in which he broke out. He obviously ran as the Libertarian Party nominee in 88. That was an easy win for George H.W. Bush in 2008. He obviously ran for the Republican nomination and did not really come that close to winning. But I think he did sort of, especially in this internet age, spark or at least encapsulate this sort of libertarian moment that may not encapsulate a lot of people, but certainly a number of folks who feel very, very strongly about limited government, not just economically, but in the bedroom as well.
Yeah, I think this is the first time you really see that magnifying effect that social media and the internet can have on a base, because the Ron Paul supporters, even though Paul himself was an older legislator who'd been around for a really long time, were very internet savvy and very on message wherever on the internet they were. It had this way of elevating the visibility of Paul while also associating him with a rabidly devoted base in a way that, if not entirely new, was being displayed in a way that we hadn't seen before.
You know, we did an episode about Bernie Sanders a couple episodes ago, and there's a lot of differences between these two, and I think Bernie Sanders is a much bigger factor in his party than Ron Paul was in his. But, like, why is it that these two older people, as you put it, Nikki, are the ones that seem to have captured this very online zeitgeist? Is that just a quirk, or what's going on there? Like, I hadn't really sort of thought of them together in that way until just now.
I think when you get two old guys who no longer give a flying hoot, that's when you can connect with young people who also don't give a flying hoot, who don't recognize the politics or, you know, the constraints of the system because they haven't experienced the system. And especially in an internet age in which ideas that might not have been able to infiltrate because the media sort of limited them now can, in fact, get through. So I, you know, before you even mentioned it, within the 5 seconds, I really was thinking of Bernie Sanders. I really was seeing this was sort of, in some ways, a Bernie Sanders of the right, insofar as you have two guys who are sort of pontificating viewpoints that might have been outside the political mainstream, but it then all of a sudden became part of our daily political culture, even if they didn't necessarily win the day.
Yeah, and I guess another similarity is their ability to do immense fundraising through small donations, especially online. You know, Paul was one of the first to do what came to be known as money bombs. These were these one-day online fundraising efforts. They would raise $5, $6, $7 million in a day. He did a bunch of them in 2007 and 2008, then again in 2012, and it really helped prove that you can mobilize this grassroots support and raise serious money through the internet.
Right. And I mean, another major similarity that I think attaches to this is that they aren't really, for slices of their career, part of either of the two major parties, that they sort of dip in and out of the major parties and then ultimately have their biggest impact when they rejoin the major party and then try to change it from within. And I think you see that in the case of both of them as these very idiosyncratic figures, often a lone vote for pieces of legislation, and often antagonistic to the parties that they're ultimately running for the nomination of.
So in terms of what Paul was advocating for throughout his career and in 2012, you know, and maybe we can stay on this kind of Bernie Sanders parallel, because we talked when we did our Bernie episode about how some of these ideas then did pull the party in a certain direction. Paul is out there talking about abolishing, you know, huge chunks of the federal government, including the IRS and the Federal Reserve, basically taking away entitlement programs, taking away funding for infrastructure. Does this move the party in a certain direction? Does it capture a direction in which the Republican Party is heading?
I don't actually think so, at least not at first blush. I mean, he did embody some of the non-interventionist part of the Republican Party. But a lot of the things that he's talking about, like abolishing the IRS, like abolishing various parts of the federal government, have been part of the Republican Party platform for quite some time. I think the other big idiosyncratic thing is probably the call for the abolition of the Fed. And while that, you know, becomes a popular slogan, I don't think it's really penetrated the party and changed the party in any real way.
Paul's 2008 run sort of presaged the Tea Party rise a little bit in 2010 that helped Republicans gain back control of Congress. But in all honesty, what the Trump rise to power in 2016 to me suggested was that, in fact, there was much more power sort of on the populist side of the Republican Party, not necessarily the libertarian side of it. It's not that the libertarians don't have some staying power within the Republican Party, but I don't think it's where the majority of voters actually are within the party.
Right. It's almost like rhetorical staying power, and it's language that feels effective and comfortable. But then if you look at the actual policy implications, they just don't seem to come through.
Yeah. And I think that Paul had his finger on some of that populist energy, although I don't think he ever really cracked the code. I mean, in 1992, he actually backs Pat Buchanan and Pat Buchanan's sort of insurgency against the sort of establishment Republican. And the two of them are not on the same page when it comes to policy. Buchanan was not a libertarian. So I think he had that outsider sensibility, but wasn't a populist in the way that the Republican base wanted. And when I talk about that kind of populism, I mean, one of the other less savory parts of Paul's background are these newsletters that he published as part of his political career. He didn't necessarily author the articles, but they contained quite a lot of incendiary racist language in them. And that's something that came out in the 1990s, came out again during his presidential campaigns in 2008 and 2012. And if you look more closely at it, you know, libertarians and the libertarian movement in the era that these newsletters came out in the 1970s and 1980s were making a strategic calculation that maybe they needed to appeal more to non-libertarians through what they saw as something that would appeal to a base of voters, and that included racism. And that connection between libertarianism and racist appeals is something that, you know, has been a real challenge for people like Paul, who, say, in 2008 had support from people like Richard Spencer and paleo-libertarians who would become more inflammatory, invisible figures later on.
One last thing I want to end on, Harry, is after 2012, I mean, Paul does okay and kind of does pretty well in some early primaries and sort of spooks the party infrastructure, I would say. And the Republicans restructure the way that they award delegates heading into 2016. So do you want to talk through a little bit about those changes? And then just in general, kind of, it feels like this happens in both parties, that you kind of fight the last war and you change the rules because of something that happened. And then it's maybe comes back to haunt you in the subsequent election.
What Paul was basically doing was going the way that, especially that delegates were being allocated in caucuses with these multiple stages, at least as it used to be. We've seen that both parties, and the Republicans really did it first, was they basically tried to streamline it so that you couldn't have these rabid supporters basically overrunning what was the plurality or majority view heading into 2016, because essentially Paul was getting all these delegates and was sort of messing up Romney's path to the nomination, although obviously he eventually got there. But that actually very much helped Donald Trump going into 2016, because it was actually Ted Cruz who had all those rabid supporters in those caucuses, in those conventions. I remember in 2016 sort of following these caucuses and conventions and sort of being, wow, Ted Cruz is doing a lot better than he does in those primaries. And so he actually made those rules that the Republicans put in after 2012, fighting that last war, in fact, made Donald Trump's path to the nomination, I wouldn't say significantly, but certainly much easier than it would have been otherwise.
Obviously, there's parallels to what Democrats have done. And every time, you know, it seems like the last few elections, they get spooked. Bernie Sanders has spooked them the last couple of times and they tweak the rules. Is that just inevitable that the only thing you're going to react to is the last one, or are parties ever going to kind of realize? I don't know exactly what my question is, but is it always going to be this way that you tweak the rules and then you realize, oh, it's whack-a-mole, you know, some other idiosyncratic part of the rules pops up in the next one, and then you deal with that, and then you deal with that, and so on and so forth.
The only thing that I'll say, I think no one, unless you're Miss Cleo, you know, you can't necessarily tell the future. But actually, for the Democrats going into 2020, when they significantly cut back on the number of caucuses, that time it actually worked for them, right? Joe Biden, that's true. Very much benefited from that, and probably would have had a much more difficult time if there were the number of caucuses that there were in 2016, let alone 2008. But always fighting that last war is always very dangerous because you're never quite sure what the contours are going to be of a primary versus a general election, where the contours are generally easier to predict.
The only thing that I would add is, you know, parties are very moribund institutions. It takes them a long time to change, and it makes it very difficult for them to predict what the consequences of those changes are going to be. Sometimes it works. A lot of times it leads to some very strange outcomes.
Well said. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Nikki, thank you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
And Harry Enten, this has been fun. A nice little 3-episode run here. Where can people find your work?
You can find me on CNN.com. You can find me on Twitter at ForecasterEnton. And once we get back to a little shade of normal, you'll be able to find me on the CNN network as well on your television dial.
You can guarantee here for us that there will be an election for you to cover. We just have to, so we're just taking a little bit of a pause.
Exactly. We will have an election. We will have one on the first Tuesday after the first Monday, but the exact shape that election takes, I think, is still somewhat to be determined.
I will also say that Harry's been doing a lot of writing on the weekend, which I appreciate. It just hits that news cycle for me nicely, so thanks again. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. You can find out lots more about the show, including how to suggest a topic. Keep them coming at thisdaypod.com. You can also email us, thisdaypod@gmail.com. And keep signing up for the social feeds at thisdaypod on Twitter and Instagram. We're really happy with how they're coming together, posting about a bunch of stories every day that we don't get to talk about on the show. So check them out at thisdaypod. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Next episode, Tuesday, we'll have a new guest, one of our favorite historians, Joanne Freeman. We'll be talking about the caning of Charles Sumner in the Senate chamber, which continues to resonate 160 years later. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
I have come to one firm conviction after these many years of trying to figure out the plain truth of things. The best chance for achieving peace and prosperity for the maximum number of people worldwide is to pursue the cause of liberty. If you find this to be a worthwhile message, spread it throughout the land.
Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday.
Radiotopia.